Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. With your host, Joe Maka. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Right now.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to this latest episode of the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo blog. And joining me on this pod, we know we'll do things differently. We'll go reverse on the roll call. Joining us in the Playa Vista podcasting room is Leander Charlakins.
I am in the broadcasting room across the country.
Joey Galino.
Hey, guys. What's up? Happy to be back.
Alex Baker.
Great to be here, Joe.
Shahan Ahmed.
I feel like I'm being wiretapped.
You and Angela Merkel. Guys, the Champions League quarterfinal draw was held early Friday. I was insane enough to wake up and watch the festivities, and it produced four fascinating matchups. First was Atletico Madrid being drawn with everyone's favorite Cinderella team, Leicester City, and then the two sides probably loaded with the most young attacking talent in Europe. Borussia Dortmund got Monaco, which for a while there, it seemed like the Barcelona-Real Madrid quarterfinal was going to happen. But Bayern Munich was drawn with defending champion Real Madrid, and then Barca got Juventus in the rematch of the Champions League final 2 years ago. So each of these quarterfinal ties will have their own intrigue. To me, the big losers were Bayern and Real. They're the two teams we've discussed as being the two top title contenders. Do you guys agree that Bayern and Real were the big losers? And also, who do you think was the big winner?
I do think that they're the two losers because, you know, they have the toughest matchups, and the same goes for their opponents by far. And this is, you know, this is the kind of match you expect to play when you get to the semifinals or a final, and this is the quarterfinals. I mean, I think we've had, you know, last year comes to mind when Atletico drew Barcelona, and then a couple of years ago, I think we had Chelsea, PSG at this stage. But, you know, this even trumps that because these are two, you know, final-level quality matches. And in terms, so I would say that they're the big losers here. I also think Leicester City, they're happy to be here. This is, you know, it's great for them to get this far. I do think they were a little unfortunate in drawing Atletico Madrid because Atleti's not the kind of team that's just going to say, oh, this is, you know, this is just Leicester. They don't underestimate anybody. And Atleti's kind of, because they're so far back in La Liga and they're lagging quite a bit, they're all in now basically on the Champions League. And so they're going to, they want to take advantage of this opportunity. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that they're going to look at Leicester and say, oh, there's an automatic, you know, two-leg victory. But I think that Leicester has to be a little unfortunate because, you know, maybe a side with a little less experience like Monaco or Borussia Dortmund would have served them better. Not that they'd be favored, but that might have been a little bit more of a positive outcome for them.
Yeah, I think conversely, I would look at Dortmund and Monaco as the winners because I think both those teams would probably think they're capable of getting through that tie into the next round. Whereas if Monaco had drawn Bayern or Dortmund had drawn Barcelona, I don't think they would fancy their chances as much. So I think that's a pretty even tie, and I think either one of those teams has a good shot.
I think the biggest loser is probably Gianluigi Buffon and Juventus.
Right.
I mean, he got his wish. He didn't get to play Leicester City. He only gets Barcelona.
A rampant Barcelona coming off a 6-1 win over PSG in the most incredible comeback we've ever seen in Champions League.
Yeah, I mean, those two quarterfinals look great. I mean, Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid, Juventus versus Barcelona, both those matches are good enough to be like all-time finals right there. And then, you know, the other two I think are going to be really exciting matches too. Because, you know, as much as you want to count out Leicester City against Atletico Madrid, which, you know, Atleti's been to the final two of the last 3 years, you kind of think, like, Leicester might, of all those teams, you're like, okay, Leicester would probably only really have a chance against, you would say, potentially three of those teams, Monaco, Dortmund, and Atletico Madrid, possibly. those four other teams that are facing each other, the four big boys, frankly, Leicester didn't want those guys. And so I think basically there's four teams that you can look at and say these are all losers because they have to play each other. Yeah. And there's four teams you could say are winners because they don't have to play those other four teams.
I also think the BVB Monaco matchup it provides the fans. The fans are winners here, obviously, because of these matchups. But you know, it's always fun when a team makes it far in the Champions League that's not usually there. I know Borussia Dortmund's won it before. I know they were just in the final a few years ago, but they're not a team that's regularly at this stage like Barcelona or Real Madrid or Bayern Munich. And Monaco certainly, you know, fits that bill as well. So I think that the fact that they're playing each other and at least one of them is going to make the semifinals is also a big win for the fans.
I think the big winner is like Joey's saying, is going to be the viewer, because I like all of these matchups because they're so balanced, I think. I mean, Atletico and Leicester are sort of counterattacking teams, and they're very good at that, and they're very savvy. So that's going to be, I think, a real game of chess. And then you've got Dortmund and Monaco that are young attacking teams that have insane amounts of talent going forward. Bayern and Real are these heavyweights that are just deep all over the place, and they're going to balance each other out really well. And then Barca and Juve. I think Barca is maybe one of the losers at this point, because PSG was such a difficult contest, obviously, where they had to pull this miracle out of their hat. And Juve is, I would argue, just as good a team as Paris Saint-Germain. They're cruising towards a sixth straight Serie A title, which is crazy. And they're deep all over, and they have this incredible knack for losing their best players every summer and then replacing them with somehow guys that perform even better. I mean, that's such a strong team, and I would argue a deeper team than Barcelona as well. Plus, they're not really fighting in the league anymore because, if I'm not mistaken, they have a 10-point lead, so they can rest guys and they can rotate guys. And I think Barca once again is in for a really big fight.
It's funny, these two, I'm looking at the fixtures, and it's like on one side you've got, you know, the four teams that are sort of always there, the Juve, the Barca, the Bayern, and the Real Madrid. And I think one of the best things about this draw is that two of those teams aren't going to make it. So it's going to leave room for, as Joey was saying, some teams that we're not used to seeing at this later stage in the tournament, which I think is for a neutral, is really cool. You know, if we're going to see a Monaco or possibly a Dortmund, or, you know, Atletico, we're a little bit more used to them at this point, but it makes for a real intriguing next stage of the competition, that's to be sure.
Let's get into a little breakdown of these matchups. Let's start with Atletico against Leicester. These two teams have met before in Europe, Leicester losing both times way back in the 1961-62 Cup Winners' Cup and the UEFA Cup of 97-98. So Leicester has shown that it can knock off a Spanish team that specializes in Europe, having eliminated Sevilla, winner of the last three Europa Leagues. But Atletico is a different challenge. And how do you guys see Leicester being able to continue its run in getting past Atletico?
I personally don't think they will get past Atletico. And I think we're probably all in agreement that, you know, Leicester is the underdog. And when I say we all, I think pretty much everyone in the world who watches the sport regularly. But this team has kind of shouldn't really be here, right? They're not one of the top eight teams in Europe.
Are you saying they have nothing to lose?
No, I mean it's not nothing to lose, but at this point they're on borrowed time. It doesn't at this point there's no reason to doubt them because they're not one of the top eight teams in my opinion in all of Europe this season, just based on how they've been playing. However, they're at this stage. So if you're going to play a team, Atletico is one of those teams where it does come down to fine margins. And, you know, Leicester can nick it kind of like they did against the other Spanish team that they just played, Sevilla, who, if you look at it, is actually ahead of Atletico in the La Liga table. So technically, they beat a better team in Spain just in the previous round. So I don't think they'll be intimidated by playing Atletico Madrid. That's if you want to be an optimist, it wouldn't be, let me put it this way, they shouldn't win, but it wouldn't be shocking. It wouldn't be the most shocking thing to happen this round.
I think it depends on, I agree with what you said, and I think it depends greatly on which team we get in both sides, because I think we all agreed that in Leicester's case, this past round of 16 clash with Sevilla, especially in the second leg, it's like, good God, that's 2015-16 Leicester. That's the team that works its ass off for each other, and Jamie Vardy, even though he didn't score like we talked about the other day, he made a lot of positive things happen. in the offensive third, and Riyad Mahrez was his typical self, and the defense was back to being steely and turning back attacks. And so you're like, okay, well, if that Leicester shows up, certainly they have a chance. And then Atletico, is the thing with them is it kind of does resemble the Sevilla situation in this regard. Sevilla, Jorge Sampaoli is very, he likes to drive his guys. They play a very intense style. And Leicester, and I'm not trying to take credit away from Leicester, but Leicester played them when they were in a glut of fixtures in the calendar. I think they had 5 games in the last, 2.5 weeks or something like that. So that grinding style, I wonder if they had, the wherewithal to put forth the effort that they should. I mean, they missed the penalties, and the second one especially looked lazy as they just kind of rolled it to Kasper Schmeichel, and it was an easy save. Atletico is going to be sort of in the same boat, because after the international break, they come back and they've got, a few La Liga fixtures, which includes the Madrid Derby the weekend before the first fixture against Leicester. And then the second fixture against Leicester, the return leg, comes just 2 days after a league fixture. So when going back to what I said, what Atletico are we going to get? Is Atletico really going to kind of mail in the La Liga like some people are suggesting they should? And, I guess... not put forth the strongest teams to focus on the Champions League? Because if they try in all these games, if they do the same thing that Sevilla did and they play their typical intense pressing style, then they could be in trouble, because they got 5 matches in 15 days when they play Leicester. And so you could see kind of a replay, so to speak, of how the Sevilla fixtures played out in the Champions League with the way that things are setting up for this round number 8 tie.
Yeah, I just want to add in real quick. I mean, we're talking about how Leicester could do it. Kasper Schmeichel has been incredible in both those legs. He was unstoppable, or he was stopping everything, I guess you would say. To have a keeper in that type of form, that's how you beat a team that's technically superior to you, is you have a goalkeeper that can stop everything and is stopping everything. So I think, as good as Jan Oblak was as well in the round of 16, I think that you have the goalkeeper being in the form that he's in will play a huge role, I think.
We're going to see an Atletico team that's going to have the ball for a large amount. So, that's what they'll have in common with Sevilla. And Leicester will be happy to give away that possession. It's whether Leicester can be, clinical, ruthless in its counterattacking, and be fortunate enough to have Kasper Schmeichel pulling off incredible saves.
I think something that's going to be really key, especially if Atletico has a lot of the ball, like Joe suggests, is keeping the ball away from Atletico's strikers. And that sounds self-evident. But if you look at the actual matchups with guys like Antoine Griezmann and Kevin Gamero and maybe Yannick Ferreira Carrasco, I mean, there's not just a lot of skill there, but there's an awful lot of speed there. And then when you look at Leicester's back line, I mean, they're used to dealing with good strikers. Obviously, they play in the Premier League. But when you have Wes Morgan and Robert Huth standing side by side, I mean, those guys, sometimes they run like they're chained up. So if Atletico manages to get those guys into the open field against Leicester, it could be a bloodbath.
Leicester just did get by a really good Sevilla team, but I don't think, I have to disagree with Shahan that I think Atletico is a better team than Sevilla. Maybe not this season, but overall, this is a much stronger team. For Leicester to get through this, they have to get out of the Calderon without getting pasted. If they could get out of the Calderon with a 1-0, 2-1, even a 2-0 loss, something, minimize it, and then score first in the next leg when they get back to the King Cup power. Because the thing about Atletico is if they win the first leg and then they're able to, I mean, they can shut teams down like nobody else. They could bring Leicester to a grinding halt. If Leicester gives up a goal to Atletico, they can get just shut down. So not getting pasted, maybe scoring first in the second leg, then I I'm trying to find a way to give them a fighting chance.
Yeah, two things real quick. And to that point, number one, I think, when they played Sevilla, Leicester, what really changed the tie around was the goal that they eventually nicked in the first leg, which turned out to be Claudio Ranieri's last game. I'm not sure Atletico Madrid is going to give you too many lapses like that to take advantage of the way that they're drilled and the way that they play. And second of all, I really think this has been a recurring theme with Leicester this year, especially in light of his success at Chelsea, but I really think that they could miss N'Golo Kanté more than ever in this tie. And by that, I mean, going back to Joe's point about Leicester having a ton of the ball, or excuse me, Atletico Madrid having a ton of the ball, and Leicester kind kind of having to rely on their counterattacking style. We just saw that Monday night game with Chelsea and West Ham, that first goal where Chelsea covered the entire pitch basically in 8 seconds and Eden Hazard finished it off was started because they had a ball winner in like N'Golo Kante who won the ball back in his own defensive third and got things started. So I'm not sure that they can Leicester can turn things around that quickly with such proficiency, and that could haunt them because those might be the best looks they get in this Champions League tie.
Wait, didn't Atletico pretty much just let a firing squad shoot at them in that second leg in the round of 16?
But they scored four away goals.
But it was
everything.
But it was at the Calderon, and they like Jan Oblak had to have one of those like really special nights to keep a clean sheet. I'm just saying it is possible. Like it's to say that they just shut teams down automatically.
I think it's possible if the circumstances are. I don't think Atleti. You had four away goals. I mean,
yeah. Do you think Atletico?
No, I don't.
And then they kind of let their foot off the gas pedal.
Yeah, but we're talking
intentionally
about
intentionally though.
No, okay. First of all, nobody intentionally takes their foot off the gas in this sport. But yes, I think
Jose Mourinho.
well played, sir. But in reality, what I'm saying is that if you're talking about them being a super well disciplined, well drilled team, and then that's just what we saw them do at home, and you know, to finish off the match. Or to finish off the tie and move on and try and convince us, I don't think they looked that great last game. I really don't. I think they let in a lot of really good chances.
They didn't, but I think it's natural. Like, what would Sevilla would have had to score? Or it's not Sevilla. I'm sorry. I'm still on that Leicester fixture. Leverkusen would have had to score two to draw even in the tie, and then another one to go ahead, right? So they would have to get at least three.
Did they have three chances last game?
Well, they did, but...
Okay, so they could have potentially scored three, and they didn't let any in.
I think it's natural when you have such an advantage like that, even for a team like Atletico. Maybe it even fits, because the way that they play most of the time, you know, obviously they didn't play that way last time, but the way that they play most of the time with that all-out effort and that press and all that stuff, like, it's natural if you have, like, an advantage like that to just be like, guys, we don't have it today for that. You know, let's just do what we need to do to get out of this, and they did.
Yeah, PSG did that, too. How'd that work out?
Well, they were playing a much better team.
Let's move on to another quarterfinal tie. At least this one, we don't have to worry about teams playing defensive. There should be plenty of goals, and I'm talking about Borussia Dortmund against Monaco. Dortmund has scored the second most goals of the teams remaining in the Champions League last eight. They have 25. They're one behind Barca, 26. And Monaco only is fifth with 15, but it'd be very surprising if this doesn't turn into a goal fest. And basically this tie is going to be essentially a summer transfer showcase for the big teams in Europe to drool over the attacking talent and figure out which players they want to poach. So my question to you guys is, you know, is this going to be a goal fest as it seems to be on paper?
Yes, and I have some stats to play around with, which should be good fun. Monaco scored 126 goals this season already.
That's it?
Yeah, that's all. In league, you know, and kind of to put them side by side so we can kind of understand, but we'll just go to league goals for now. Monaco has 84 league goals in 29 matches in Ligue 1, which you can say, well, it's Ligue 1, it's a joke, whatever. PSG has 58, and PSG generally is like considered, you know, they're an overpowering force in that league. Monaco has 26 more goals than PSG in the league. You know, you go to the Premier League, Liverpool has 60 goals and 28 to lead the Premier League. Monaco has 84 and 29. So unless Liverpool scores 24 goals the next game, I think Monaco's got them covered pretty good. Bayern, again, if you want to go to the Bundesliga, Bayern has 60 to lead the Bundesliga in 24 games. So they need 24 goals in their next five games to match Monaco. Monaco has pretty much shown that they are the best scoring team in Europe from what we've seen, not in the Champions League, obviously, but I just mean in terms of consistently on a week-in, week-out basis. The only team that's close is Barcelona with 77 goals in 27 games, and they have to basically score six goals in the next two games to tie Monaco. But whenever you're talking about a team that's, you know, starting Falcao and Mbappe, and you're comparing them to Suarez, Neymar, and Messi, you know there's something right going on there. To kind of move on back to some of these youth that I just kind of mentioned, the average age of that lineup that just started was 24 years and 2 months. This team should, like, to be in the final eight and have a real shot in making it to the final four, this team is really just punching way above his maturity level is the way that I'll put it. Because these guys are just raw talent. They run at a fierce pace, and they score goals.
Can they keep up with the Dortmund side? That the question here is, who can stop whom?
Well, Dortmund had 53 goals in 24 games so far this season, which is not nearly at the level of what Monaco's been able to do. So I think Aubameyang, though, you know, when we look at the top goal scoring charts in Europe in the Champions League alone, you have Messi's on 11 goals to lead everybody, and then who's second? Aubameyang's actually second, not Cristiano Ronaldo. Ronaldo only has 2 goals in the Champions League, and the last time he scored was back in September, which is insane. But when you look at it, Aubameyang, that's pure pace on one end and pure pace on the other. I hope nobody stops anybody. I want to see 20 goals. I mean, we already had, you know, the round of 16, which had 62 goals, and that was a record. I would love to see them do 62 goals into the final eight. I know we have half the number of games, but like Leander said, this is a joy for anybody who's a fan of the sport or who just enjoys watching fun matchups and fun games, because all four of these matchups are awesome, and this one is probably going to be the most high-scoring of all of them.
But we've seen Monaco in stretches, especially this last round of 16 tie, where whether it was lack of experience, where the attack is not clicking, the other team is on the front foot, they have issues in the back, just like Dortmund. How intimidating is it going to be for them for that first leg, going to Dortmund and facing the yellow wall? I mean, you mentioned how young this team is. They have and Lander in his draw post today, a lot of these prime attacking talents that they have, they're 22 or younger. So, you know, it's pretty intimidating just to be at this stage in the tournament, but now they have to go to Dortmund for the first leg. I don't know. I mean, it could be daunting. And if these guys aren't up to it, Dortmund will run the roughshod over this team.
They will. I think that I honestly, if they play it on a neutral field, I would tip Monaco to win for a couple of different reasons. But I think one thing that could even that out is the atmosphere. And we talked the other day about how Monaco is not a side that, you know, the Champions League crowd for the Manchester City game the other day was fantastic. But that's not usually how it is. So when if you look at it from Dortmund's perspective, they're probably thinking, well, you know, it's going to be tough, but this is not the worst place to play away, especially at this stage of the Champions League. Meanwhile, as you said, Monaco has a lot of young players, and now they're going to one of the most intimidating home grounds in all of Europe. So that could be a challenge that could tip things the way of Dortmund. And I think that they have to, because it might come down to health. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Aubameyang, even though he woke up in the second leg of the Champions League tie just now, he missed the DFB Pokal game this week with the thigh injury. Marco Reus is still out. I think Götze is still out. Like, there's, you know, even though they're very deep with attacking talent, some of the best guys aren't going to be available, you don't figure, for this tie. And that means when you're trying to, basically, we all agree this is going to be another like 6-6, 7-7 tie or something like that. And if you're trying to keep up in an arms race, so to speak, and have the kind of firepower to match Monaco, that could matter, which is why I say things like playing for the first time at the Westfalenstadion could balance things out when it comes to deciding who moves on.
I think it's important to keep in mind that when you compare those two teams, yeah, they both have really strong and talented attacks. And if Monaco is young, so is Dortmund, absolutely, I think, because, you know, our good friend Christian Pulisic, and I'm amazed that Joey hasn't gone on a big man crush rant yet. But
I'm kind of surprised, too.
I tried to loosen the reins a little bit and let you guys get a word in edgewise about him.
Wait, who is Christian Pulisic? Never heard of him.
He's this guy from Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Hershey, well, Pennsylvania.
He's 18. Ousmane Dembele, who's one of their key attackers, he's 19. I mean, you know, the Dortmund isn't that much older, but by any means, they have a few guys that are experienced. Aubameyang is 27. Schürrle is a little bit older, obviously, but they're not a team that's you know, a veteran side either. But I think when you compare those two squads, there's a lot of things that are more or less equal. But I think that Monaco has an enormous benefit in their defense. Because Monaco, when they got to the quarterfinals 2 years ago of the Champions League, they really rode their defense. And now they're kind of the opposite in a sense, where they're scoring lots of goals, but they're still not bad at all in the back. I mean, they've got Fabinho at right back and Benjamin Mendy at left back. And they're some of the best young upcoming backs in the game, I think. They have a really strong back line that I don't know has gotten a lot of credit yet, but I think those guys pretty soon they're going to be at bigger clubs and they're going to be household names, which is a hard thing to do for defenders. At the same time, you do talk about Dortmund having the home field advantage that's completely lacking from Monaco, because I don't know if you've ever seen the Monaco stadium, but even when it's full, you know, it's got a big track around it. It's not that big. It's not a very daunting place to play. But I think in this tie, the defense is going to make the difference, especially because there's so much attacking talent. So for me, I'm pretty confident that Monaco is going through.
I think this is a pretty even tie, but I would certainly give some edge to Monaco. And I know they don't have the atmosphere and they have to go and play in the very daunting home Dortmund crowd. But I just think if you look at what they've done in this tournament this season, they've been by far the stronger, more spectacular team. And I think Dortmund, I know they held Real Madrid to a couple draws, but I still feel like they're kind of untested in the Champions League this season, apart from that. Whereas Monaco got through a pretty tough group, you know, knocked out City, knocked out Tottenham. I kind of give them an edge. And plus that City result that was so spectacular last week, they did that without Falcao, who's arguably their strongest attacking force, and he'll be back for these upcoming games.
You say they're untested, but I believe they finished first in their group.
Dortmund.
Yeah, Dortmund did. And
but who was their group? Legia Warsaw? I mean, apart from Real Madrid, it was
well, apart from Real Madrid.
Well, I'm saying, but
Real Madrid's kind of a big deal to finish above in the group stage. It's kind of glossing over that one a little bit. I'm just saying they did play Real twice in the group stage and they managed to finish top of that group. Yes, okay, in the round of 16 okay. They didn't get tested, but I would just say that this team, it understands how to play in Europe, I would argue, and it's so far this season also to finish atop of a group that involves Real Madrid is the defending champions, I'll add, is not any short feat.
Let's talk about Real Madrid. They have Bayern Munich, as we've said. These teams have played 22 times in the European Cup, the last time 2014 in the semifinals, and Real won that tie 5-0 en route to the La Decima, their 10th European Cup crown. You know, it's a shame that these two teams are facing so early, meeting each other so early in the knockout stage. But ultimately, what is going to decide this tie? What do you guys think is going to be the determining factor?
I mean, they're so evenly matched in terms of just quality in every position and depth in every position. So I'm going to have to look in terms of managers, and you've kind of got a master and student scenario with Ancelotti meeting Zidane. So I'm going to give the upper hand to Bayern just because of Ancelotti's experience at this level.
Yeah, I think that the key is that Ancelotti is not so far removed from having managed this specific team. And I'm not saying that Zidane hasn't come in and made changes and has them humming in a whole new way, but it's just Bayern Munich has been such a force this season, especially now it seems like they're getting it together at the right time in the Champions League. And they just got they have that army of wing players who are just dangerous on the outside. So that might nullify the fullbacks who like to get forward for Real Madrid a little bit. You know, it's very evenly matched, like Alex said. There's a lot of talent on both sides. But if you're going to tip the scales in one way, I've been saying that Bayern Munich's going to win the Champions League since last summer. So I'm going to have to go with them. Ancelotti is one of the keys. Like I said, tactically, I think that they won't be able to go forward as much as they would usually because of the threat that Bayern Munich possesses going the other way. Plus, this is where you're really going to see, you know, the defensive improvements that Bayern Munich has tried to make, you know, bringing in Hummels, and that's going to be kind of like tested here because you've got so much attacking firepower with Real Madrid on the other side. And I think those fortifications, plus the stuff I mentioned earlier, kind of tips the scale slightly to Bayern. Plus, no team's ever won the Champions League 2 years in a row, and you know, Real Madrid is finally probably going, oh, this is why it's never happened, because something wacky happens like this and you draw Bayern, freaking Bayern, in the quarterfinals. But, you know, I'll you know, just a long story short, I do think Ancelotti tips the scales to the Bavarians ever so slightly.
Yeah, I mean, going back to what I think one of you guys mentioned earlier was the Madrid derbies right around the time when the first leg is, right?
Yep.
So I said, you know, even going into this season, I think preseason, I wrote that this is the year for Real Madrid to win La Liga. And I think that having won the Champions League two of the last 3 years, they're in that position where I think that the league is going to distract them enough and they're going to focus on winning the league, because for these players, a lot of them, they haven't won the league at Real Madrid, and it's been a while for, I mean, it's going to be, I think, the first time in 5 years.
5 years, yep.
So for them, I think that what's the distractions domestically will have an impact, whereas Bayern doesn't really have that issue. And if all things are equal or they're about the same, I think the ability to focus on the Champions League and not have to worry as much about the domestic league definitely does have an impact. And, you know, we saw that last year with Barcelona, where they were on this great run, and then El Clasico happened, then they had to play Atletico Madrid, and that was around the time when they basically just fell apart for about a month, and that was the end of their European campaign. And that's kind of what ends up happening in Europe when this happens.
There's an interesting wrinkle on both of these teams. As you alluded to, Shahan, Real Madrid plays Atletico right before the first leg, and it plays Barcelona right after the second leg. I mean, those are tough, tough games for them to be wedged around their quarterfinals. But I think if you look at this Bayern team this year, you're starting to wonder a little bit about age, I think. I mean, Arjen Robben and Frank Ribéry are up there. This is Philipp Lahm's last season. Xabi Alonso, it's his last season. I mean, that's not such a super young team anymore. And, you know, this time of year, that is when that really starts to act up. And Real Madrid sort of fairly quietly, I think, has built a lot of depth into their squad, even though they have that tough schedule coming up. I mean, they're a team who can bring Lucas Vazquez and Alvaro Morata and James Rodriguez and Mateo Kovacic and Isco off the bench. I mean, there's enough talent on the bench at Real Madrid to compete for the La Liga title all on its own. So they're kind of built to be fight two fronts at this point, which I don't know that you can say about Bayern.
All right, let's move on to the last quarterfinal tie. It's Barca against Juventus. As we've said, this is a rematch of the 2015 final, but this is not the same Juventus, obviously. There's no Paul Pogba. There's no Andrea Pirlo, no Arturo Vidal, no Alvaro Morata, and even no Carlos Tevez, who's enjoying big bucks in the Chinese Super League. But there is still Max Allegri.
But didn't Tevez leave to go home and be with his family in China? His family in China?
Apparently, yeah. If that's a story, I guess he's going to stick with it. But Max Allegri's still there. So my question to you guys are, you know, what chances do you give Juventus of knocking off the comeback kings of Barcelona?
I think Juventus has a really big chance because for all those guys that have left, you know, they've gotten Miralem Pjanic and they've gotten Alexandro and Gonzalo Higuain and they've gotten Marco Piazza or Piazza, however it's pronounced, and Paulo Dybala.
It is Piazza.
Piazza, okay, that's what I thought, just as it should be Christian Pulisic. But anyway, they've gotten Paulo Dybala. And this is a better Juventus team than it was in 2015, even losing all those guys. They're deeper and they're more balanced, I think. And again, like I said, you know, they've got a big lead in Serie A, which Barcelona doesn't have. Barcelona is a thin team. Barcelona's kind of running on fumes as it is. You know, they've got Luis Enrique leaving. Barcelona, I think, right now is as vulnerable as they have been in years. And I would absolutely not be surprised to see Juventus going through. I think they have at least a 50-50 chance.
I hate what I'm about to say because I've made fun of Serie A on this podcast before, and I'm just basically inviting scrutiny from Shahan. But I'll go this far. I would be very surprised if Juventus doesn't win this tie. I think when you look at the name recognition, of course, you know, anyone who's not been paying attention would say, oh, Barcelona should probably be favored. But to build off of Leander's points, Juventus is replaced the guys they had a couple of years ago with people who are arguably been more effective. The Dybala and Higuain tandem up top is completely scary. I would argue it's scarier than what PSG just threw at Barcelona, and they had their fair share of success scoring goals. Juventus is complete. The one thing I would say about Juve at this point is, even though they've got the big lead in Serie A, I wonder if the fact that they haven't really had to play one of those titans so far this season, we saw that for years with PSG. They'd race out to big leads in their league, and they would kind of struggle once they were really challenged in the Champions League. Now, I'm not saying I don't think it's going to happen. I think Juve is way too good and way too experienced for that to happen. But if there's one thing that could kind of draw them back to the pack, so to speak, against Barcelona, I think it's that. I think it's the fact that Barcelona's had a few huge matches this season. And Juve, I don't know if you can really say that. But, I think that Juve is playing as well as anybody. I think that they're put together very well. And I think Barcelona, you know, despite that miracle comeback that we just watched, is as ripe for picking as ever, especially at this stage of the competition. So, again, I would be surprised if Juve doesn't win.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not going to anoint Juve favorites necessarily, but I will say that I think that right now they have been the more consistent team than Barcelona this season. There's a pretty strong case to make for Juventus, even though I still think Barca, you know, first 11 on their day is still, you know, quite the better team. But this one to me really could go either way.
Yeah, well, domestically, Juve didn't run out to that giant lead that they, you know, they have a bit of a lead now. But
yeah, not a huge one.
Well, they didn't run out to anything like that. And they did have some big games that they had to turn up for domestically. And they did. Juve has been a very, very consistent, good team. And, you know, the Higuain addition is something new. Pjanic addition is also new. And both those guys have looked worth the money that Juve spent, which is basically Paul Pogba's transfer fee was reinvested into those guys. Now, one thing I will just quickly add before I get off the mic is I actually, before the season started, thought that the two deepest, strongest teams were Bayern and Juve. And I said, you know, obviously the draws come into play, but I think that these are the two teams I'll meet in the finals. Having them draw Real Madrid and Barcelona makes it a little bit tougher to say that, but I'll stick with it. I still think that Juve is completely solid, and I think Bayern is completely solid. So I think Juve, to progress past a Barcelona side that, you know, we'll equate it to, you know, it's March Madness going on in the U.S. It's kind of like when you saw a team like Syracuse win their conference tournament where they go to triple overtime. That's what Barcelona just did against PSG. Now when you get to the real tournament, you're kind of already, you already accomplished something incredible. It's you almost run out of gas, or you're running on fumes because you went through this entire emotional roller coaster. Now you get to the next thing, and it's not quite the same. It loses a little bit of its fire. And I think Barcelona, granted they're a great team and they have a great coach and all, I think that they have their potential to kind of already have hit their high point for the season.
Yeah, I think just real quick, I know that some of the defenders for Juve have struggled with fitness this year, but as long as Bonucci's in there, I trust that part of it. And obviously, Gianluigi Buffon, you mentioned it earlier, this is what you want. So, you know, bring your A game against Barca. And the other thing with Juve, I think 10 different players have scored for them during the Champions League this season. So it's not, you know, Cavani was great last round, but you kind of figured, you know, okay, if PSG is going to make something special happen, Cavani's going to kind of have to be that linchpin. With the guys we mentioned, Higuain, Dybala, Pjanic, like they even have Mandzukic. You know, there's a lot of different guys who could be the goal scorer, who could be the difference maker for Juventus, and that's one of the things that makes them really dangerous to stop.
They also have Dani Alves, I'll just add in.
One of the things that really bums me out, guys, is that these are going to be 8 games that are probably all going to be very good, if not great. And every single time, 2 of them are happening at the exact same moment. That's something that's always bothered me about the Champions League. And apparently they're going to change that next year, where they're going to stagger the games a little bit. But I just think it's such a shame that for so long, you know, Borussia Dortmund Monaco is going to be happening at the same time as Juventus Barcelona. And I don't know about you, but I have a really hard time looking at 2 games at once.
Final thought on Barca, Juve. You guys are all making a really compelling case to pick Juventus, but just like in Barca's last tie, they were on the road first. They're playing at Juventus Stadium, and I could totally see Barcelona getting overrun again by this Juventus midfield, whoever they throw out there. I was actually able to watch some Serie A, believe it or not, when they played AC Milan, and the teenage goalkeeper from Milan is
Donnarumma.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's incredible. He's been incredible too.
But Juventus created chances left and right, and a lot of it came from the midfield. And you know, I totally get what you guys are saying.
But
it took one player to lift Barca to that amazing comeback. It was Neymar. I mean, Neymar.
It wasn't really. Ter Stegen.
Ter Stegen tackle was crucial.
You're leaving the referee out, Joe.
That's going to be the focal point of the movie.
Yes, that's being made right now.
No, but yeah, I get it. Juventus is a very talented, well coached team. I just what we've saw in the last round, Barcelona is able to do incredible things when they're at home at the Camp now. So that said, I could still see it going either way, but I'm going to pick Barcelona because of the star power that can just, you know, maybe this is Messi's time. to rescue Barcelona. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, talent-wise, you can never discount Barcelona. Yeah. It's just chock full of talent. But I'll just say that Juve, this is about as balanced, you know. And actually, the Bayern Real one is too. These two ties are just, these are the four best teams in Europe. If you were to ask me, you know, the four super teams, these are the four super teams, and they're playing each other. It's going to be tons and tons of fun.
Let's move on to the Europa League and quickly discuss their quarterfinal draw. And really, this is no offense to you, Leander, the Ajax fan, but the only matchup that we care about here in America, Man United got Anderlecht, and which Rory Smith of the New York Times posed an interesting question for United. Should United forget about the Premier League and just focus on winning the Europa League to gain qualification for next year's Champions League? If you were Jose Mourinho, what would you guys do?
Yeah, I think it's their best route in. It's the easiest route in, not best route. It's the easiest route to get in, because you look at the Premier League and that top six is brutal. And to make it in the top four, where United's behind, and I think I saw somewhere where they've been in the number six spot for 100 days this season. They've pretty much been cemented to the number six spot in that top six. Although they've been flirting with number five, they've like moved ahead, you know, for a day or two. Whether they hop back when teams catch up on games played, it's going to be real tough for them to move into that top four and, you know, move ahead of Arsenal, frankly, who has been cemented to the number four spot for going, you know,
about 20 years,
for forever. So. It's going to be tough. I think that when you look at it, Anderlecht, and then you look at the rest of the field, and there's no one really that jumps out at you. And you kind of look at, you're like, where is all the competition here? There's no Spurs. There's no, you know, Sevilla was in the Champions League, so they're not there to reclaim their title for the fourth year in a row. You look at it, and Ajax is probably going to end up being their biggest competition, which I'm totally setting Leander up for this. But it's, you know, we're at that point in the competition where it's down to eight, and you look at the other seven, and no one comes close to United in terms of the squad that they have.
Yeah, first I want to say that I care about Ajax and Schalke. you're not alone, Leander.
We love Schalke.
Schalke loves Joey. but I do think actually United has, if you look at the rest of their domestic fixtures this season, they have Chelsea, you know, at Old Trafford. But apart from that, you know, they face Arsenal away. They face Tottenham away. Those are tough fixtures. But they have a lot of pretty winnable games on the docket for the next couple of months. So I don't put it past them creeping up there, especially based on how fallible the teams above them have proved to be this season. So I wouldn't say that this is their only shot at making it into the Champions League next season.
It's interesting you bring that up, and I'll just get this out real quick before we go to Leander. If United, they've got two games in hand, and even if they win those two games, they're only level with fourth place, which is where Liverpool is right now. And Arsenal also has two games in hand, and if they win, which is no sure thing, God knows, but if they win, that they would be in the fourth place spot. And you just look at some of the Premier League fixtures that United has. They still have to face Everton and Chelsea at home. I think their last two or three weeks is brutal. I think they're back to back at Arsenal, then at Tottenham the next week, which is just going to be really tough. So I think the best way to look at this is, yes, the Europa League is the path of least resistance, you could say, to the Champions League, because you definitely take your chances with the other teams in that competition as opposed to the ones in the fixtures that I just mentioned domestically trying to get into that top four.
It's a high-risk strategy, I think. I mean, if you're in the Europa League, so you've got Anderlecht in the quarterfinals. Let's say worst-case scenario, you get Celta in the semifinals and Lyon in the finals. I would probably take that any day over trying to get by Liverpool and Arsenal or possibly Manchester City or Spurs, you know. But then you've got 12 games left in the league to pull that off, which gives you a bigger margin for error than trying to go the Europa League route, because in the Europa League, you have to win the final. even if you get to the final and you don't win it, it kind of doesn't buy you anything. Only the winner gets a spot for next year's Champions League. And, you know, a lot of different things can happen in a final. I mean, as Manchester United certainly knows, if you think back to that 1998 final, I think it was, or 1999, where they sort of turned it around against Bayern Munich in the 89th minute or something like that. So it's a risky way to go. But it still seems like, to me, it's United's best chance of being in the Champions League next year. And if they're going to keep rebuilding, if they're going to sort of continue their progress back to where they once were, sort of the top of the heap, it's so important for them to be playing Champions League soccer, because recruitment over the summer is really difficult when you're not in the Champions League.
I mean, we're talking about Jose Mourinho, and if there's one thing Jose Mourinho loves, it's a final. So if they make it to the final, I'm probably betting on Jose to pull it off.
Well, that and the path of least resistance.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, it would. I think it would be a huge disappointment on the season if they don't finish in the top four, even if they win the Europa League, just based on, then you're essentially, you spent a ton of money in the summer and you still couldn't finish in the top four.
That's what I was going to bring up. If you're a Man United supporter, and I'm not, I mean, you should have enough depth to compete on these two fronts, right? I mean, they lean so heavily on Zlatan
right.
to get goals, and it shouldn't be that way. You've got plenty of attacking talent, plenty of what should be depth, and all of the lines that they have. Yet, you know, if you're in this position where you have to choose one or the other, if I'm a Man United supporter, I think it's ridiculous. I think you need to, you know, I know this question is being brought up of maybe this is the best way to get into the Champions League, but, you know, they should be able to compete on both. And wherever the chips fall, play your best guys in the league, play your best guys in Europe, and, you know, they shouldn't have to choose between one or the other.
Well, Jose is not necessarily going to choose, and we've seen he hasn't really rotated his squad that much.
He hasn't.
But
also, he hasn't brought along the talent that's there. I mean, Anthony Martial is, you know, what's happened to that kid?
Well, right now what we're looking at is, what, Zlatan's still going to be suspended coming up this weekend. Pogba looks like he got injured, so I doubt he'll be available this weekend. And Jose is already complaining about the fact that it's an early kickoff after he played on a Thursday. And he already said, you know, we'll probably lose along those lines. He's setting it up for them to pretty much throw the league away. I think that if they're behind in that type of way, I don't think they'll necessarily, like, tank the league. But I think he'll make it pretty clear, like, hey, we need to win the Europa League. And it is, when you look at the competition, it is a much easier way to get into the Champions League. And, you know, the ends justify the means, I guess. It doesn't matter what they did along the way, as long as they end up in the Champions League next year. And then they're back to square one in the sense that, hey, we still have a really strong squad. There are a lot of young players in this team that are progressing and improving over time. Next year, we'll be in the top four is what they'll sell.
Yeah, I think, you know, going to what you said, Joe, it shouldn't be that way. But for you, people who aren't United supporters, the people who are actually working for the club, the trainers and the coaching staff and the bureaucracy, so to speak, and the players, like, you obviously have to think, you can't think that way. You can't be like, well, this is what it is. So now we all agree that the big key is getting back in the Champions League so you can buy those players over the summer and so you can offer something to them, you know, and tempt some of the big talent. And the best way to do that, I think, is still going through the Europa League route. And I also just wonder if them losing in the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, and I'm not, you know, again, the FA Cup's been devalued. I'm not trying to say it's a major tournament or anything, but if they had another couple set of fixtures for the FA Cup semifinals, once those are gone, and now you really literally only have the league and the Europa League, I wonder if that just made, you know, streamlined things, and that was kind of the final nail in the decision, if it has been made, in fact, to go all in on the Europa League and try to go in that way.
I think what's interesting here is that United already has assured itself of being in the Europa League at the very least next season because they won the EFL Cup, previously the League Cup. So in that sense, the downside of not tanking the league as such, but sort of, you know, playing it in fourth gear rather than fifth, which is maybe a very European thing to say, but is the downside of that is pretty small because let's say worst case that they've somehow they rotate guys and they lose a few games and, you know, Mourinho blames it on the schedule and everything. But let's say Everton overtakes them, right? Let's say it goes completely wrong for them in the league because they're not completely committed to it and somebody overtakes them. They're still in the Europa League next year. So if they want to double down on winning the Europa League this year, you know, the risk of that isn't that enormous because if they don't end in the top four in the league, it's also okay for them to drop out of the top seven.
One thing I'll say is that United didn't really look that great against Rostov that second leg. They could have lost that were not for Sergio Romero making some pretty good saves, including one I believe is right before the final whistle. They actually, he had to make a save. It went out for a corner, and they blew the whistle on the match, which is
it would have gone extra time.
Yeah, if he makes it, he goes extra time. Before they scored that goal, there were a couple chances where you're like, oh, wow, Rostov could actually win at Old Trafford and
who
move on.
Who needs style points?
It's like Mourinho's saying, no, you guys don't understand. We literally have to focus entirely on the Europa League because that's the point we're at. We're not going to win otherwise.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, this team, from what I've seen, hasn't necessarily displayed the ability to say they're going to win this competition or any competition. The consistency is what's been lacking. You know, it's been better than last year, you would say, in terms of the way that they play and the quality, but they've also spent a ton of money to get to that point. Yeah. I'm just saying, it's not really a done deal. I would say that Jose is playing with a little bit of fire if he just starts tanking the Premier League and focuses on the Europa League, and then they don't win the Europa League, because I think that's a real possibility.
Before we get out of here, we need to talk about the U.S. Men's National Team. Bruce Arena called in 24 players for the upcoming World Cup qualifiers, March 24th in San Jose against Honduras, March 28th in Panama. Really, the big question, well, let's talk about the issues here. It's Brad Guzan won't be there because he's staying home for the birth of a second child, which means Tim Howard is the clear-cut number one, you would think. DeAndre Yedlin has a thigh injury, and Timmy Chandler isn't coming because he's suspended, and Arena felt it wasn't, you know, he didn't want to bring him all the way from Germany for just one game. So there's a question at right back. There's also a question at left back. Well, there's a question with Fabian Johnson, who may not play because he got hurt in the Europa League. But the big question for us is, where does Christian Pulisic play? Arena had plans playing him centrally, it seemed like, before this Fabian Johnson injury. Now it looks like he'll be back on the left wing. But is that where Pulisic should play? And what should be the formation? Leander, you start.
I like him out on the flank. And maybe that's because that's where we've seen him the most with Dortmund. And we've sort of programmed ourselves to see him out there. Certainly he can play centrally. But you've got other options in the middle. I mean, you could pair Darlington Nagbe quite easily with Michael Bradley in the middle, I think, in a home game against Honduras. Because Honduras, we should remember, has fallen off quite a long way since 2014 when they were a pretty strong team. Jermaine Jones is out for that game, so he's out for the first game, so he's out of the picture. And Alejandro Bedoya can play centrally as well, although he's more of a box-to-box guy, and I think Bruce Arena would really like to have a playmaker in there at number 10, which is more Nagby's role. So I would expect Pulisic to be out wide, and I think he'll do fine there. I think Bruce's hands have been tied a little bit. By the way, one quick thing I want to say about Timmy Chandler not going, I think that logic is really weird of saying we don't want to bring him all the way over from Europe to play just one game, because players do that all the time. Mostly for World Cup qualifiers, or very often it is just one game, or you do have a friendly somewhere and players travel halfway around the world for just one game, and nobody ever says, oh, well, it's not worthwhile if it's only one match. So I don't know if that's used as some kind of excuse there, but I thought the logic in that was pretty strange.
I thought it was weird too, Leander, and it's a little suspicious that if this guy right now in the pool is the best right back for the U.S., then he should be playing in that game in Panama. Because really, with the U.S. having no points after two games, you really can't cut corners. So that you're right. The logic doesn't make any sense.
I don't want to get too deep into this, but I almost wonder, too, if Bruce Arena is kind of, you know, rebelling maybe is the wrong word. But, you know, Chandler was a guy who featured obviously a lot under Jurgen Klinsmann, and he's trying to move away from that. I don't want to read too much into that. I'm just wondering if there's a little more to this than there may seem. Going back to the point about Pulisic, I think that more than anything, maybe Bruce Arena doesn't want to. I think he should play him out wide, and I think it's not because he can't excel in other areas, but because he's having this great run of success at Dortmund when he's playing out there. So it's almost like a guy that young and in matches this big, why upset the, you know, why rock the cradle, so to speak? Like, why upset things? Why not keep a good thing going in that regard? And hopefully he'll be as effective for the United States out there as he has been in Germany.
Yeah, I think you got to play Pulisic, excuse me, wide, because without Fabian Johnson, I just don't see another obvious choice for a player who we can put out there who can stretch defenses and create openings. We don't have that many players like that in the pool currently. I know Jones will be out for the first game, but you know, after that, you can go back to the time true and tested midfield pairing of Jones and Bradley. You could put Pulisic on one wing, you could put Bedoya on the other, and then you know you got your two strikers, whether that be Josie and Clint or Josie and Bobby Wood.
Well, that's another question. And you know, Bruce typically plays two strikers. It'd be somewhat of a surprise if he went with one up top. Who do you think is the best pairing with Clint back in the mix? It's Altidore is a better fit with Wood, I think, because of the mobility of Wood. You know, he can move around, work around Josie, work off Josie. Clint in his later years is a little more stationary. And actually, if you're going to play Clint, it'd be better if you put Clint in the hole behind the front two, so he can be that, you know, facilitator. But Leander, I mean, how do you see that situation with the two strikers and where, and what is Deuce's role going to be?
I agree with you completely. I think Altidore and Wood are the best striker pairing. I think they believe that. I think everybody really believes that. Even Jurgen Klinsmann did, because you've got Wood, who's such a dynamic, quick striker, covers a lot of ground, and he lets Altidore be a target man. And it took Altidore a really long time to sort of realize that that's what allowed him to be his best. But I think when he went to Holland, he sort of finally came around to it. But when he's basically the stationary striker and Wood has room to run around him, that's when it works best. And this is really the first sort of set striker pairing that I can recall, going all the way back to Altidore and Charlie Davies in 2009, before Davies was injured. That's really how long it's been since the U.S. has had a set front line, aside from Altidore playing up there by himself. I think at this stage with Dempsey, you can play him in the 10, but then if you play only one central midfielder, you're going to have to essentially shackle Michael Bradley to that holding role where he's sitting in front of the defense or even between the central defenders and not moving, which doesn't, you know, he's very good at that, but I think when you give him a little bit of room to get forward and help distribute, that brings out good qualities in him as well. Another option is playing Dempsey out on the opposite wing to Christian Pulisic, which is what he did under Bob Bradley. He was a winger for the national team. Or you use him as a kind of late game energy type of guy when you need to break down an opponent. And it feels like blasphemy to talk about Dempsey that way, but he is 34. And I think we have gotten to a point where there's a better pair of strikers without him. And I think he'd be helpful in that role. And Arena hinted to that in his statements when he released his roster that, you know, he wasn't sure what kind of role Dempsey was going to play, but even off the bench, he could be useful.
How do you guys think, or what do you guys think about the back line? Who do you think is the best back four to go up against, well, Honduras, really, for that first game?
Oh, boy. I mean, you want Brooks and Cameron in the middle, I would think, for your center back pairing. That seems to pick itself. But then after that, it's
Bruce in his Facebook Live session on Wednesday was talking up Cameron, right, Lander? Talking up Cameron as a right back option, which doesn't give you much going forward.
No.
But, you know, he has played there for a club. So, but I feel like, yeah, I mean, it should be Cameron and Brooks, I think, is the pairing.
You could put Omar next to Brooks, maybe, you know, as a
it would be Bruce makeshift. To trust Omar.
It would be very Bruce.
Yeah. I'm going to answer the question. I'm also going to bring it up to a little bit broader of a point. I do agree that Altidore and Wood, it would be the best pairing up top. On form, Wood is the guy that, you know, you'd want up there more than anybody right now. I almost wonder this. Because we're so close, we can kindly kind of address, you know, just the magnitude of these qualifiers. We've kind of paid it lip service, but you get no points or maybe even 1 point over these two matches, you could kiss the World Cup goodbye. Yeah. So I wonder if Bruce Arena is going to rely on, if maybe he's going to sacrifice interchangeability and positional, you know, intelligence just to get Dempsey on the field, to get Jeff Cameron on the field. It looks like Tim Howard's going to be the goalkeeper now because they've been in those huge matches and he recognizes how important it is to get points out of these matches. I wonder if he's not going to rely on these fixtures who've been there forever despite what it may sacrifice in other areas.
Well, he's been saying since he's been hired that his job is to get some wins here and to get some points on the board. CONCACAF is a famously forgiving region to qualify from. 3 out of 6 teams qualify directly. A fourth will go to a playoff with the fifth place team from Asia, which will probably wind up being like Iraq or Saudi Arabia or someone like that, which should be pretty doable. So in that sense, you really have to screw up to not qualify. But I think Joey's right. I mean, I think you don't get results in these two games, and you really are in danger of not qualifying for the first time since 1986. To answer Joe's question, Bruce said that, you know, Michael Orozco or Jeff Cameron are his options at right back, which scares me a little bit because, like you alluded to, neither of those guys give you really anything going forward. Someone like Tim Ream at left back also doesn't give you anything in the attacking sense. You'd basically be playing with four center backs. But, you know, maybe that's the way Arena wants to go. Maybe he wants to keep his backs at home and really have a block back there to lock things up and kind of also create the freedom a little bit for his forwards to and his midfielders to commit forward. It's not looking super good, though. I think we all have to concede for the defense going into this game. I mean, they're pretty thin there.
Yeah, I think Brooks you can pencil in, obviously. Like Leander said, they're talking about playing Jeff Cameron outside. I think you would go with that because it's more experienced and he's finally back from injury. And I also think that the point Leander mentioned about this, you almost, when the U.S. is trying to evolve, you know, kind of chasing that evolution that Klinsmann kind of spoke of in terms of how the team plays, it might almost be better to just kind of relax the reins on that a little bit, let the defenders defend. And there's a lot of attacking talent that has been selected for these two qualifiers. Let them do the work. Don't worry too much about wheeling guys forward and you know, messing around on the wing and kind of doing things that might leave you exposed. You know, let the guys up top do what they do, and it might almost be a better recipe for the United States and leave fewer holes going in the opposite direction that could be exploited.
As we're recording this, a press release just rolled in from U.S. Soccer that Fabian Johnson has been taken off the roster for these games and replaced by Graeme Zusi, and he is listed as a defender, so he's another option at right back.
So, yeah, the Graeme Zusi right back experiment just is won't back die. On.
Continues.
Yeah.
Phase two.
All right, thanks for that bit of breaking news, Leander. We got to go. Thanks, everyone, for listening in. Please review our in iTunes, the FC Yahoo podcast, and check out our Facebook page, which we've been doing Champions League wrap-up shows after every Wednesday during a Champions League week.
I might make the next one on time, too.
I love the fact that you came in right in the middle of it. It really made that video, to be honest.
You weren't even invited, Joey.
No.
You just showed up.
That's been happening my whole life.
All right, guys, thanks for Leander Charlakens, Joey Galino, Alex Baker, Shahan Ahmed. I'm Joe Lago. This has been the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. We'll catch you next time. Thanks. Bye. Please edit that.